This question and answer session was held on the final day of Gutenberg College's 2010 Summer Institute, entitled Democracy, a User's Manual. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2010. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We're in housing the homeless and that kind of thing. Isn't that something that's part of Christianity? And then the second question is, what's wrong with the government doing that? I mean, doesn't it seem like it would be very compassionate and efficient for the government to take over the responsibility for the poor people who have various needs and collect money and distribute it? So what's the problem with the church doing it, and what's the problem with the government doing it?
Well, it's important to make a distinction between the social efforts to address social problems by Christians. That's not the social gospel. And Christians have for centuries been active. In fact, some people would argue that on the forefront of addressing social problems, feeding people who are hungry and helping people who are poor get out of their poverty and helping people who are physically debilitated in one way or the other and giving them aid, that Christianity has been on the forefront of addressing those problems. That in and of itself does not make the social gospel the social gospel. The roots of the social gospel, there was an American thinker named Walter Rauschenbusch, who was basically a socialist and tried to take socialism and the spirit and vision of socialism and reinterpret it into Christianity. Take Christian concepts and evacuate their actual biblical meanings in some cases and infuse them with a new meaning that's informed by a kind of socialism, even at times Marxist kind of vision of reality. And really from then on, it's had different permutations, but typically what people mean when they rail against the social gospel is they're not at all opposed to the social compassion. They're not railing against that. What they're railing against is the idea that Christianity is not the faith that Jesus and the apostles taught, but rather Christianity is this new good news of how through discipleship and obedience to Jesus, Jesus is going to bring about a new era of social justice in the world. I mean, it's that vision and the various permutations of that they're opposed to. I can just get us started.
This has been a real interesting issue for me, and I wrote a couple of papers on it when I was in seminary. In a little bit of Rauschenbusch's background, he's writing the early part of the 20th century. He moved into Hell's Kitchen, New York, and it's just flamed out. It's just a horrible place to live. And he sees all these families that are coming to his church. He's a pastor. And they're just desperate to just kind of try to earn a buck. And it seems like they have really honest to goodness, genuine problems. And he writes his first book about the social gospel. And if you read it, it's actually really balanced. It's fair. He doesn't sound terribly socialistic. But as I understand it, when he's writing, the modernist and the fundamentalist, or maybe the evangelicals, are starting to part ways at this point. And the modernists, what we would now call the liberals, really like the social gospel. And they kind of take over Rauschenbusch's message, and he kind of goes with them and drifts farther and farther to the left. Now, at the same time, you've got people like Dwight L. Moody, who says, he has this famous quote, "When I used to preach the gospel in the city, I would carry in one hand the Bible and in the other hand a loaf of bread. But I stopped carrying the loaf of bread because I realized that the scripture was what fed eternal life and the loaf of bread didn't really matter." So that's a bit of a problem, as far as I understand it. It seems like he had it right earlier on. He was carrying a loaf of bread in one hand and a Bible in the next. So what happens is sort of there comes a split in Christianity between the liberals and the conservatives, and the liberals sort of say, yeah, we're all about social action, and sort of as a reaction, the conservatives are saying, well, we're more about the gospel, and they don't see that those two things seem to be connected, and that seems to me like a false bifurcation.
Well, two things, I think. FDR sold his agenda by appealing to the third man. Was that right? The third man. He actually got that from an essay that was written, I think it was by a Harvard Forgotten Man. Sorry, yeah, the Forgotten Man. From an economics professor who was basically saying, was really basically exposing the problem with statism. And the problem with statism is person A gets together with person B, he says, and they see some problem in the world, and they agree together that that problem needs to be addressed. So they tell person C that he needs to pay money to address this problem over here. In his essay, the forgotten man was person C, who is being, against his own will and not voluntarily, having money taken out of his pocket to address some other problem over here. And in the essay, he was the one that was called the forgotten man. You know, what we're not doing is paying attention to the fact that you're stealing from somebody to take his resources to address some problem that you, A and B, have identified as a problem. But what about him? Does he have no say in the matter? He's the forgotten man. FDR shifted that and made the people who have the social problem the forgotten man, and he completely transposed what the phrase meant. But that original essay, I think, really gets it right, is the difference between the government doing it and you and I doing it is if you and I do it, several things are true. One, we're doing it freely. We're doing it voluntarily. No one is robbing me. I'm freely giving of my time and energy and resources and money and so on. And that has all kinds of spiritual value. There's no spiritual value to the forgotten man that he had resources that somebody ripped off from him and used to address some social problem. He doesn't get anything out of it, even spiritually. But if I am acting out of love, there's a great reward in that for me, both in this world and in the age to come. There's a reward for me. So leaving it to me to take care of the problem gives me the opportunity to be Christ-like in my response to the problem. And then the other problem that has been often pointed out is when a human being is meeting the need of a human being, I am in a position to address the actual human needs of the human being in need. Typically, bureaucracies don't do that. Typically, government programs are reductionistic in what they understand the need to be and are rather rigid in how to take care of the need. Back when the welfare system was really going strong and I was a pastor in California, I'd get people coming in off the street with financial needs. And more than once, I'd have people come in who are on welfare, and they'd say, I just need money to pay the tuition for this class, and then I can get this skill, and then I can get a job, and then I can get out of this life that I'm in right now. And I'd say, great, sure, we can do that. We can pay that tuition. But there's a problem. If you give me the money to pay the tuition, I have to report it to the welfare office and they'll reduce my welfare check. I mean, it just, the rules put handcuffs on all of us, which ultimately meant people can't help people. If you want help, you come to this office and we will help you, and we will only help you so much, We won't help you beyond what the regulations allow, and we certainly won't take into account your special circumstances. And I just found it incredibly frustrating. We tried to find ways to help anyway, speaking about doing an end run about this around the system, but if we played completely by the rules, we weren't supposed to.
An interesting book by Bastiat. His name is spelled B-A-S-T-I-A-T, Frederick Bastiat. He has a book called The Law that kind of fills out even more this notion of what Jack is talking about to some degree. He was writing as a contemporary of de Tocqueville, but he really fills out the sort of problems with taking from one person the forgotten man, the true forgotten man, and giving it to someone else. Anyway, he develops this concept of plunder that is very, very interesting and I think is really helpful.
One of the things that I've heard people say in discussing this topic is the government, just by nature, has to come up with not very granular criteria at all about who gets help. I mean, you fill out this form, if your income is a certain level or whatever, if you can swear I've been, you know, applying for jobs and everything, you just get this, you get a hunk of money. There's no way to, there's no way that they don't even try to determine, is this person actually genuinely in hardship through no fault of his own? So that he's genuinely someone who really wants to help? Or is this someone who is fundamentally lazy and we're enabling that we're actually hurting him by helping him? And whereas I, as a person, if I know someone, I can be, and especially if they're in community with me, I can know their circumstances, actually know them as a person, know, if I, hopefully I have some wisdom, combination of knowing what his circumstance is and actually knowing what is good for a person given a particular circumstance, I can say, you know, I don't think it's really the kind of thing for me to just annualize cash here. That's what you say you need, but I disagree that that's what you need the most. Or maybe I need to keep you alive and hold you accountable at the same time. So figuring out what a person really needs is a lot more complex than
Jack was more generous than I would be. He said that it doesn't often allow for that kind of, the system doesn't often allow. I would say that the system is designed to not allow for that, the kind of judgment and discernment that's necessary to assess what's actually needed in a situation. Because it's the nature of bureaucracy to take judgment out of it. That's why a bureaucracy exists. That as much as possible, the rules are written so that you can plug any worker into any slot, and they just shuffle the papers and follow the rules, and you're supposed to get the right result, and you get the same result in every instance. It's objective. Exactly. And so it's designed to take judgment and discernment out of the process, and that's exactly what's needed in order to respond to an individual's unique set of circumstances.
I went to this church in Atlanta, and it was right in the middle of downtown Atlanta, and Atlanta's got a lot of pretty large indigent population. There was a woman that came to our church. Her name was Karen. She was living in a battered women's shelter. She had lost her job. She was in bad financial straits. But the thing that she kept talking about over and over and over is she used to be able to play the harp. Apparently, she was a fine harpist. And so a lot of us at the church were trying to think about, okay, I mean, she doesn't necessarily need, the harp is not like the thing she most needs to keep afloat, but it's the thing that she wants more than anything, because in the harp, was all sorts of dignity for her, and also like a strong, strong sense of like, this is who I am and this is what I could do. Harp is an expensive instrument, so we are bending over backwards to try to find some place that we could rent a harp for her, have her borrow one, but even moving a harp, how do you do that? Long story short, when I moved out here, we still hadn't found a harp for her. But then I went back to my church when I was home over Christmas break, and they had found a harp for her, and she was playing as part of this Christmas processional, and she was like a completely different person. And I was friends with her, and I talked to her a little bit. Nothing else in her circumstances had changed. Nothing else whatsoever. But this harp was so, pardon the cliche, but so instrumental in who she saw herself to be and this gift that God had given her. And it just seemed like, you know, our church could kind of recognize that. I don't imagine any bureaucracy would actually say, yeah, let's get her a harp. That's the thing that she chiefly needs.
I think that also illustrates that when you take from person C to give to person D involuntarily, and not only does person C not get anything out of the requirement, but person D is on the end of a machine, and they don't receive they're not communicated love in the process. I mean, there's a kind of sterilized love there, but nobody's saying, I'm making this as a voluntary sacrifice on your behalf. That element is just totally removed, and that's an important part of what we need to communicate to people. The other thing, totally different question. Yesterday in the reading, it came I think David's lecture came up that one of the ramifications of sin is that man is constantly looking for a personal advantage, and basically God frustrates that, and so there's this futility that results. In business, I find that the operating paradigm of business, especially in the high-tech industry, is you're constantly looking for a business advantage. It's not quite on the personal level, but that a business doesn't have to be very big either. And usually, it's the business advantage, you're creating an advantage for the business owner or owners, and it very often results in futility because you create this business advantage and then somebody steals it from you, one way or another. Is that something that we're called to as believers, to leave that rat race, basically, I guess? And I'm not saying that we're necessarily required to. I guess it's the you know, you were talking about the difference between in Romans 13, whether that we're required to obey the state or whether we're allowed to obey the state. I'm looking at it and saying, well, I feel compelled to play this game, this rat race game, in order to keep food on the table, support my family. Is my perspective correct in that regard, or is there a promise of God that I can somehow shed this kind of futility? And maybe that's too specific a question to be, I don't know, I'd like to get your response.
I don't think that there's any reason that we have to leave that sphere of human activity. That pursuing a personal advantage there's a sense in which we do that all over the place, and that's not wrong. Playing a sport, any number of kind of spheres of activity, we do that. The question is, what are we willing to trample as we try to do that? That there are moral constraints that are put on us with respect to that, and there are some things that we ought not do. But within those constraints, that's all part of the struggle that life is. So I don't see that there's anything inherently wrong with being in that realm of activity.
I didn't make that noise. Just a comment kind of that went with what you said and then what you were saying at the beginning about the human connection. When I went to college, I got a Pell Grant, not a very big one, but, you know, it was money. And I really didn't feel a bit grateful for it. It wasn't from anybody, you know what I mean? But after college, when I went to Argentina for the first year and a half, I had to raise support to go because I was going as a quote-unquote missionary. And I felt intensely grateful to everybody who was giving me money and praying for me and wishing me well and thinking of me. And, I mean, just kind of to illustrate, like, I don't think of myself as a, you know, obnoxiously ungrateful person. You know, I certainly have my moments. But, you know, in general, I am grateful for things. But it didn't even ever occur to me to be grateful for the Pell Grant. So.
So in the picture of A and B decide to take money from C to give to D, is there an ethic or morality about whether or not D accepts what is being given them, whether they need it or not? Just because A and B decide it needs to be given, should D be exercising some kind of something?
Who invited you?
Well, Bastiat thinks that Bastiat in that book argues that taxation is plunder. It is inherently immoral, I think, for that very reason. but that's the problem. So much social critique looks at where we've come to and sees where sin and immorality and evil and greed and selfishness has taken us, and we find ourselves in a position where there's really no way we can extricate ourselves from it. The realities of our life just are the realities of our life. I mean, arguably, if man weren't sinful, there wouldn't be parking lots, maybe, right?
That's right.
Right? But good luck with that. I mean, we're not going to extricate ourselves from the kind of mode of life that we have, that has evolved and has developed and we've got ourselves into. So we have to be willing to live with, we have to be willing to live lives that are already sinful, that are already compromised with evil. I mean, that goes back to why Elul was so frustrating to me, because he was describing a situation where all of us were implicated in the evil that we're all enmeshed in, and the Puritan in me wanted to say, well, no, not me. How do I get myself out of this? And there's no way. He doesn't let you escape. So part of coming to terms with biblical Christianity is coming to terms with the reality that my life is deeply compromised already, and one of those ways, I'm sure, is accepting a Pell Grant is exactly that situation. And we could become puritanical about it and decide, well, not me, I'm not going to make somebody else steal for that. But then we're basically turning our back on all the structures of our lives that make it work right now, and I don't know that it makes any sense to do that necessarily. So, you know, maybe the thing to do is to take the money and weep that we live in a world where this is the way it's done.
This is the same as Jody's question. I mean, like when you had the Pell Grant, I mean, there have been times in our lives when we've been recipients of what I now see is government aid, but had never thought about it. Didn't, you know, it was just so part of the culture that you just accept it and you know, wouldn't have been a question. But now it would be a question. So now when you know, I mean, are we obligated? Well, maybe everybody has to answer that for themselves, but is the question different now? I mean, even things like Social Security, or if the medical system, you know, if there's general health care and your loved ones are sick, do you take advantage of that, or you just refused to take advantage of it out of principle? I mean, where are those kinds of questions?
Just to piggyback on that, you know, and where do you say, well, I've been paying into it, so... Like, my parents pay taxes all this time, but they also paid money to send me to a Christian school, so they never actually took advantage of any of the money that was supposed to pay for me to go to public school, and that was less than... I'm sure they paid more into that than I got out of the Pell Grant, because it was, you know, a couple thousand dollars. So, yeah, there's that question, too. I'm already in the system, and I'm forced to contribute to this system, so do I say, well, I will pay into it, but I'll never reap any benefits, or am I going to try to keep some sort of mental calculation? Well, I paid this much, so I'm going to take this much out, or, yeah.
Yeah, I'm just repeating myself, but maybe let me be clear. I think there's a puritanical impulse that is a desire that all of us have, and that is that as a disciple of Jesus, I'm going to make my life so moral and good and just and pure that I am not involved in any evil. And that's what I'm saying is we're not called to that. We're not called to free ourselves from all guilt. We won't be able to do it. I am guilty in so many ways I can't count them just by breathing. My more important point I forgot. I'll think of it.
While you're thinking of it, the point about that Bastier or whoever it was said about taxation being plunder, it just made me think, oh, so the difference between the Romans and the Goths is that the Romans had the organization and the willpower to go out and conquer and then tax, whereas the Goths and whoever, they just plundered. You know, they did an incomplete conquering and direct taxation.
I'm going to say my college experience was a lot different. In that, I was on the 21-year plan, as it turned out, which I don't recommend. But part of the reason for that was, a year and a half into it, I ran out of money because that's all I had. I saved up money for about a year, and then was able to get through a year of college, and then worked for another half year. Went back to school for another half year. And then my work after that was basically I was living hand to mouth, and I couldn't get back to school for a long time. And what underlied that was I wasn't getting any aid from anyone. I couldn't get, go into the financial aid office, and they said, first thing we need is a parent's confidential statement. I can't do that. Because I was perhaps falsely, but I understood that the family rules were you don't pry into the my parents' financial information, so I can't ask for that. What's the alternative? Well, you can get a student's confidential statement after you've been on your own for 2 years. By the time I was on my own for 2 years, it's like now I have to work so much that I can't get back to school because I can't get enough money. Anyhow, and the alternative to that was, ask my dad for money, which I had. The answer was, well, we'll see. After a couple of decades, I saw. But there was yet another underlying issue is my dad was a Mason. He made it clear that there were Masonic scholarships I could get. All I had to do was become a Mason. And I was deeply aware that Masonry was essentially a form of idolatry. You have to basically do obeisance to quite a number of gods in order to be a Mason. Like, in that instance, it's like, yeah, I can accept that money and deny my faith at the same time. It's not that worth quite that much to me. So I said, okay, no, I'll live hand to mouth and I'll do whatever I can, and if the Lord gives me the education, he does. Which, like I said, I don't recommend the 21-year plan, but that's what I got. I think so. There are times when it is, I think, appropriate to say, no, the money's not worth that much to me. And in particular, you know, it's not a matter of staying pure. I'm not sure that I've got plenty of sin to go around. But trying to maintain a testimony in the process of all of that, there's a cost associated with that, and sometimes you need to say no.
I remembered my other point. The flip side of my last point was that the temptation is, because of this desire to think of ourselves as keeping ourselves pure, is that I will take the money and then I will rationalize that nothing unjust is happening here. It's important to, we may find ourselves in a position where we will have to be compromised by evil, but the important thing is that we call evil evil even as we're implicated in it. It's important to resist the temptation to find a way of saying, no, it really is okay. No, it's not. I mean, on the grand scheme of things, it may be terribly immoral, and I just need to recognize that I'm implicated in an immoral system that necessitates that I go this direction.
Speaking of immoral organizations, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. I've been in and out of, in some of my iterations, I've been in and out of the propaganda business a little bit. But I was wondering if you were to try and distill down a message or two that you wish Hollywood would image or surface based on what we've talked about this week, would anything come to mind along those lines?
You mean what is it? What would we say to Hollywood? Or? Yes. Yes. In Lewis' book Propaganda, he says, when discussion starts, propaganda ends. And his point is, when people's minds are really engaged, now this is no longer propaganda. The art of propaganda is conveying something to someone without engaging their mind, without it being a real discussion, without it being a real give and take. And that's happening all over in our society. Hollywood is doing that, but there are others that are doing that as well. And that's what needs to turn around. That,
well, in changing your message, if you said from a message standpoint that it sounds to me like then what might happen is that at the end of some sort of movie or something, people would be driving home in their car and then they would begin to speak. And they begin to talk, they begin to discuss.
Mm-hmm. Right.
What would you have them discuss?
Oh. You mean, if your question is what does our world, what do they most need to hear? Oh, repent. I mean, as I just Yeah, that. As I look at the Bible, it seems to me that that is the message that shows up on every page, and that is the message that human beings need to hear, and I can't think of a more important message, that we need to come to terms with who we are and who God is, and act wisely in response to that, and that's repentance. But how do you make that heard? How do you make that clear and make that heard? That's a difficult task.
I mean, one of the things, the corollary to that is, notice how completely excluded the seriousness of dealing with God is everywhere in the media and popular culture and everything. I mean, even as vigorous as religion has remained in American culture, not in the mainstream. In the mainstream of American culture, if you introduce God into it, you are one weird, odd. So to normalize that somehow, to normalize taking the reality of God seriously, would be a huge step in our culture. To actually let people know that it actually is an option, that you can live your life in the light of the reality of God and take that seriously, which is the predecessor to repenting.
You need to talk more about the question that we were asking before, because maybe just the way I think, something about what you said just doesn't sit right with me. I mean, I understand about not justifying your evil and calling it evil, and that we have to, that we participate in things that, because of the culture and stuff that we're in, that we just, I mean, it's just part of our lives. But it almost, but if there are some, if you're confronted with some, some issue that you really feel is evil, and yet it's so much a part of the fabric of our culture, I mean, and it seems like, the idea, and when you refer to your puritanical you, seems like there's something, that there could be something else at issue too. I mean, wanting to do right, knowing that you can't do right all the time and that you sin, but if there's something right in front of you, it's like you, and in a way, it takes some kind of bravery that you don't have. I mean, there's some loss or some suffering that's going to happen to you if you don't do the cultural thing. It seems like it's still right to do that brave thing that's going to cause you suffering than to just tell yourself that, well, this is just part of what our culture is like, and, you know.
No, I think so, absolutely. If I just feel compelled to make a statement in the direction of righteousness through my actions, that's always a good thing and a right thing to do. I'm not sure we can pass judgment on other people if they don't feel the same need in this particular way at this particular time, in this particular mode. I don't know that I can make that call for other people. But yeah, I think you're right. There may come a time where before me and my Creator, I just decide I've got to draw the line here. I've got to take a stand. And if I really believe that this is an inappropriate way for the society to structure itself, I'm not going to participate. Yeah.
But it is important to recognize that if I hold a gun to Charlie's head and say, hand over your money.
Oh, I'm
safe. He thinks I can't hit him. And I take that money and I give it to Jack. Jack should reject that. Taxes are a different kind of thing. It isn't that simple. It's much more complex than that. And so it is so much more a part of the warp and woof of our society that it's not that simple at all. So that's what we have to recognize. That's really complex. I've mentioned this before, but just taking the Pell Grants as an example, you could reject all financial aid, federal financial aid. That'd be fine. That'd be very noble. But then you have to pay for that out of your own pocket, and you're paying a lot more money than you would otherwise pay, because the system is what has driven tuition so sky high, the system that's based on financial aid. So it's very complex.
No, I didn't turn it off. So this isn't really a question, but it seems like going along with all of that is just that no matter what you do, because of the way the system is, it doesn't matter what choice you make, it will somehow involve you on the wrong side of things. Like, even if you decide to completely pull yourself out and become a hermit, well, then what are you doing? You're ceasing to put out, you know, whatever influence you have on the culture. So it seems to me that you can't avoid it. You can't avoid implicating yourself. You have to choose your battles and do what's right to the best of your ability, but you can't control the effects three steps away from the decision you make. Yeah, there's no perfect solution, and you can't avoid that. It goes along with the sphere of responsibility that we read about in the guy's name, who I forgot.
One of my colleagues was a very liberal lady, radical lesbian feminist person, and one time we were getting some kind of I think it was a kicker check from the government, and we were discussing was that a good idea or not a good idea or whatever, and I can't remember actually what it was we were getting, but and maybe it wasn't a kicker, but the money that the government was going to give to stimulus money or something like that, and whatever it was, I was against it, and so she was trying to find a way for me to ethically accept it without my conscience bothering me, and she said, "I've got an idea, give it to something that supports children," and it was sort of like, It was really insulting. I said, "What makes you think I don't give to things that support children now?" And she sort of looked like, "Well, you know," she didn't say this, but the look on her face I interpreted as, "Well, you're a conservative. You're not interested in supporting children." And I mean, it was time and time again. I really actually have come to become good friends with this lady, and we have really interesting conversations, and she will talk. I mean, she thinks, she will talk, she will listen, and I've learned things from her too. But one of the things I said to her once was, "Lorraine, you are so delightfully smug." I mean, she never seems to be able to get away from her primary presupposition that she has got the high moral ground for everything. I don't love children because I'm a conservative. I hate gay people, which she is, because I'm a conservative, and I would never do any. But she's come to realize I'm a little bit of an exception there because I don't spit on her and that kind of thing. And so there's this high moral ground that it seems like a lot of liberal people have, that ends up justifying about anything they want to do. And so I think of this as kind of the Robin Hood phenomenon, that everybody knows that people who have lots of money are selfish, money-grubbing people, the whole stereotype. And so there are people who are living like Bill Gates in this, incredible mansion and, jet-setting around and all this kind of thing. And then there are people who are living in ghettos and they have terrible health problems that can't be solved because they don't have insurance. And everybody knows this is actually true. There are people like that. So there are wealthy people and there are people who have much more than they need, and then there are people who have much less than they need, and some of these people are like that for very good reasons. I mean, for nothing, they are actually, they've been victimized, they've been, you know, they are hardworking, they want to do the right thing, and it just, they have had a hard time of it, and they are the worthy poor. If anybody knew their circumstance, we would be just happy to give them a leg up because they deserve a leg up. So if you, in your mind, you kind of separate into you've got the money-grubbing rich and you've got the deserving poor, and so we've got built-in good guys and bad guys. Good guys are the poor and the bad guys are the rich, and Robin Hood is the person who's dealing with this injustice. It's very simple. You take from the rich, you give to the poor, and solve injustice. So my question is, what's wrong with being Robin Hood? I mean, it seems like a stupid question, but when you, regardless of what you think's really going on, there are needy people with not enough resources for various reasons, some of them good. There are people with way more resources than they need to keep themselves alive. So what's wrong with redistributing the wealth? Why is that? Why shouldn't we do that?
Well, instead of being Robin Hood, we should be Mother Teresa's. I mean, it's not to solve the problem with the with coercion rather than voluntarily, I think is fundamentally wrong. And if you want to be a Friar Tuck, if you want to spend your life persuading people that they need to be Mother Teresa's, then great. I mean, that's fine too. But it's a really kind of inappropriate, unjust shortcut to just say, I'm going to rip you off, and I'm justified in my ripping you off because I'm going to give it to somebody who's worthy.
Because you obviously have more than you need.
Yeah.
Never mind your circumstances or, you know, how that...
And the other thing I mentioned in our group, a book that I've read recently that I found very helpful is a book called Money, God, and Greed by Jay Richards. He's writing specifically to Christians who are interested in what the Bible has to say, but the subtitle is Why Capitalism is the Solution and Not the Problem. And in a nutshell, I think what he would argue is redistribution is fine. It's the method of redistribution that's the issue. Do you do it through thievery, or do you do it by increasing wealth for everybody in the society so the resources are there for poor people to, with real dignity, to offer services and products to those wealthy people, and the wealth of those wealthy people gets redistributed to them in a manner that is free, voluntary, doesn't involve coercion, because there's more wealth in the society to go around that can make its way to poor people by them, and also having dignity by making their product, their creativity, their hard work available and getting paid for it, get money for it. You know? It's still redistribution, but it's a different method of redistribution.
So,
I'm sorry. I think also in our society,
well, the rich are playing the Robin Hood.
Yeah.
Except for the giving to the poor part. Is there a problem? Is there an injustice? Let's say everybody has the resources they need to stay alive. They have enough food. They have health care. They have a house. It's not a palace, but it keeps the rain off their head. But they don't really have the wherewithal to take a one-week vacation to Disneyland. They, you know, they have to wear the same outfit for a couple of years on end till it actually falls off them. rather than having a new outfit every year or something like that. But and you have other people who have who jet set all over the place and eat at restaurants all the time and that kind of thing and have every new electronic device. Is there an injustice, that disparity? Is that injustice? And if not, why not?
Yeah, I don't think so.
Could you elaborate?
Well, I mean, that Jesus said, a lot of people just blow this off, but Jesus says, the poor you will have with you always. So that really comes back to our discussion of Brothers K, Dostoevsky, and so on. God does not deal equitably with his creation and with creatures in the world. He didn't make everybody equally intelligent. He didn't make everybody equally strong. He didn't make everybody equally tall. I mean, our experience, our created experience, is full of inequity. We are all distinctive. We are all different. We have different virtues, different strengths, different weaknesses, and so on. And in the way he's running his universe providentially, he made some people rich and he made some people poor. I think it's an act of rebellion to say, that was a huge mistake, God, and we're going to fix it. Because you ought not to have made it so that some people have more and more privileges and more abundance than other people. I mean, if I'm poor, one of the struggles of my life is coming to terms with my Creator has put me in this condition. I can either flip him off or I can bow the knee to him. And that's the fundamental decision of my life. Which am I going to do? Am I going to accept the limitations that God has placed on my life, or am I going to beat against the boundaries of my life and insist that my life has to be different? And it seems to me that what Jesus is always calling us to and is giving us the example of, I mean, if we wanted to complain, think about Jesus. Jesus says, or God, it's not fair. You're going to make me die for the sins of the world? I mean, how fair is that? Why don't you pick somebody else? I mean, he's given us the model for that. The role that God gave him was not a desirable role, but he voluntarily accepted it, not without great struggle, but at the end was able to resolve his will, not my will, but your will be done. That's really the crisis that each of us in our own way face in our life. We confront our limitations, and then we have to ask, am I going to accept them, or am I going to reject them? And ultimately, what James says is, so often is the case, it's the poor in this world who are rich in the kingdom of heaven. So the believer who comes to belief through confronting the limitations of their life ends up being ultimately richer than the rich man in this world who lives a shallow, superficial existence, jet-setting from here to there, and never come to terms with what it means to be a creature before his Creator. You know?
Oh, did you have a question?
Yeah.
Okay, this is the absolute last question.
Okay. With that last question, are you expecting both the rich and the poor to be humble in their position?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely.
And doesn't that create, that humility create some charity?
That disparity of wealth, it may not be unjust, but it is an opportunity, and it should be seen that way. It's like somebody's sick. It's not unjust that somebody's sick, but it's an opportunity for compassion, so and ought to be seen that way.